Chief Justice, may it please the court.
I'm Giancarlo Conoparo.
I'm Zach Smith.
And welcome to SCOTUS 101, where we break down what's happening at the Supreme Court, what the justices are up to,
and other things related to our favorite branch of government.
Welcome back to SCOTUS 101. GC, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Zach. Welcome back. There are two developments to talk about this week. You want to start us off, Zach?
Sure thing. Well, I can guess both of those developments involve Donald Trump and cases he has going on right now. So first up, we'll deal with the new case that the court has agreed to hear. The court announced that it will hear former President Trump's presidential immunity case on April 25th. So stay tuned. I think that'll certainly be a very important case that a lot of people will be watching very intently.
And you're right. Of course, the other issue this week is the decision in Trump versus Anderson. Zach, why don't I summarize the case and you can talk about the implications?
Excellent. Let's do it.
All right. So Trump versus Anderson, the court unanimously held that Colorado cannot kick Trump off the ballot under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So by way of a very short review, Section 3 says, in short, that nobody shall hold office under the United States if, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States, he shall have engaged in insurrection. Lastly, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment says that Congress may enforce this provision by appropriate legislation. There were many ways that the court could have decided this case. It could have said that the president is not an officer of the United States, that the presidency is not an office under the United States, that Trump did not engage in insurrection, that the provision is not self-executing, or that the state officials have no power to enforce the provision. In the opinion, the majority, which was per curiam, that means written by the court, so we don't really know who the author is, the court said two things. First, that state officials have no power to enforce Section 3 because, number two, only Congress has the power. It's on that last point that there is disagreement among the justices. The majority says that only Congress can enforce Section 3 and that it knows of no enforcement legislation on the books. Now, that's an interesting point for two reasons. First, there is a criminal law that makes insurrection a crime, and there is a law called the Electoral Count Reform Act, which says that during the joint session of Congress where they tally the votes for president, members can object to a vote if it is not, quote, regularly given. So if Trump wins, could Democrats say on January 6th, 2025, that votes for Trump are not regularly given because, in their view, he falls within the ambit of Section 3? Well, the implication from this decision is that the answer is no. Why? Well, because the majority says that any enforcement legislation must satisfy the test from a case called City of Bernie versus Flores. That is a case holding that there must be congruence and proportionality between what Congress is trying to do with a particular law and the means that it employs to do it. So what do we take from this? Well, that the Electoral Count Reform Act and the law that criminalizes insurrection are not clearly tied to Section 3 and don't count as enforcement legislation. Both of these laws are general. Both of them don't mention Section 3. The Electoral Count Reform Act is about counting, not about insurrection. The criminal provision includes no penalties other than normal criminal penalties. So I think the implication is that they don't satisfy the City of Bernie test. The three liberal justices concurred, saying that they agree that states can enforce Section 3, but that the majority went too far in setting guidelines for how Congress can enforce Section 3. They didn't think that that was necessary to decide the case. Their opinion is very pointedly written, comes across as acrimonious. Although it is a concurrence, it reads like a dissent. Now, the majority responds to them at the end of its opinion and says, in effect, if we're going to give a complete explanation of why states can't enforce Section 3, we have to explain how Congress can enforce Section 3. And that brings us at last to Justice Barrett's solo concurrence. It does two things. First of all, it says, I agree, states don't have enforcement authority. I also don't think we should talk about congressional enforcement because it's not necessary. But then she goes on to attack the concurrers for, and I quote, amplifying disagreement with stridency. Writing of the court, she said, should turn the national temperature down, not up. For present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. That should be the message Americans take home. So that's the opinion. Zach, what do we make of all of this? Where does it go from here?
Well, how much time do we have, GC? I think there's a lot we could certainly talk about. But look, the bottom line, of course, is that Trump was on the ballot and is on the ballot going forward. The Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, reversed the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court. It also undermined the decision of the Maine Secretary of State and the Illinois court decision that kicked Donald Trump off of the ballot in those states. And so for now, at least, the immediate issue has been resolved and Donald Trump made it onto the ballot. Now, of course, there could be future litigation challenging some of his presidential actions on the basis that he was ineligible for office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but I suspect those types of challenges really won't go anywhere. You know, if you read the majority opinion, if you read the concurrences that were issued, you know, it becomes pretty clear that the majority opinion held that in order for someone to be disqualified for federal office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, there has to be some type of congressional action. It's Congress's responsibility to issue the enabling legislation to enforce that constitutional provision. Jamie Raskin and other members of Congress have said that Congress will enact legislation to potentially bar Donald Trump from the office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We'll have to wait and see if any of that legislation passes. I doubt that it will, but certainly there may be movement in Congress on this front. Now, I also found it interesting, GC, what the Supreme Court said about states. The majority opinion in this case was very clear that states can disqualify those running for state office under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And so it'll be very interesting to watch and see if there's any movement on that front, whether any current or future candidates for state office are kept off of the ballot, certainly in blue states, potentially, for actions that those individuals who are running for office took in the wake of the 2020 election. So very interesting case, very important case, and likely not the last word on this issue.
I think you're right about that, Zach. Well, that's it for Supreme Court news and opinions. That brings us to my interview with Judge Kenneth Lee right after this.
The Heritage Foundation is the most effective conservative policy organization in the country. Every semester, our interns are a vital part of that mission. We pay competitively, we develop talent, and we give our interns access to some of the sharpest minds in the country. We're going on offense, so join us. To learn more about the Young Leaders Program here at the Heritage Foundation, please go to heritage.org/intern.
We are joined today by Judge Kenneth Lee, who sits on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Judge, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy and honored to be here today.
So, Judge, before we talk about your legal career, I'd love to hear about your family history. Your parents fled from South Korea when you were a child after the 1979 coup. Can you tell us about why they fled and what that was like?
Sure. You know, when we think of South Korea today, I think most people think of Samsung or maybe Hyundai or, you know, heaven forbid, BTS. But, you know, back in the 70s, you know, Korea was still a fairly poor country. It had been only, you know, about a quarter century after the Korean War. It was also highly corrupt and, you know, very unstable. And I still remember back in 1979 when my dad was explaining on a piece of paper to my grandmother of what happened when the head of the Korean CIA assassinated the Korean president at the Blue House, which is their version of, you know, the White House, which, you know, sounds like something from an Oliver Stone, you know, conspiracy, you know, a tale. And then shortly after that, there was a military coup and the military took over the government. You know, that those events, I think, were, you know, something that broke the, you know, proverbial, the straw that broke the camel's back. You know, I think our parents wanted more stability, more freedom and more opportunity. So, you know, our family came to the United States and we settled in the Koreatown part of Los Angeles.
What was it like coming here, you know, uprooting it? What were you, 4 years old?
Yeah, around that age, yeah.
What was that like?
Sure. Yeah, I guess first I'll say, you know, every day, you know, I feel grateful and blessed to live here, to be a naturalized citizen and to enjoy the opportunities and freedoms we have here. You know, I know some people will find it corny, but, you know, I love this country. you know, we're not perfect and we haven't always lived up to our ideals, but you know, I'm one of those types who, you know, still gets a little bit misty eyed whenever we hear the national anthem during the Olympics. So, you know, I want to first, you know, say that, but you know, at times it was difficult, you know, when you move to a new country. I think it was far more difficult for my parents and my three older sisters, because they were older, but you know, for example, the language, I didn't speak English. No one in my family spoke English. And in the Koreatown part of LA, most people there didn't speak English either. So, you know, I learned English at first by listening to the Dodgers on the radio with Vin Scully, and also by watching professional wrestling on TV every week with my grandmother, who loved wrestling. So, you know, I learned English by, you know, listening to radio and watching a lot of TV. And you know, I wish I could say it was because I read Hemingway or Shakespeare, but that's not the case. And, you know, I will say, you know, my dad really emphasized the importance of learning English because for him, you know, that was an impediment to his career here in the United States. He was educated as an engineer in Korea and worked as an engineer, but when he came to the United States, because he couldn't speak English, you know, he couldn't get a job as an engineer. And you know, he, you know, worked and supported our family by fixing spray paint machines, and that's what he did for 30 plus years. So he always said, if you want to succeed in America, you got to learn English. You know, and you know, my response was, yes, sir. And then, you know, turn on the TV and watch, you know, professional wrestling every week. But the language part was difficult. You know, culturally, you know, it was, to assimilate at times was difficult because, again, as a kid, you're always trying to fit in somehow. And when a different culture, you know, it was difficult at times. You know, I think in the end, I mean, you know, the opportunities that we have and the liberties we enjoy, you know, completely overwhelm whatever difficulty that I may have had earlier on as a kid.
So what eventually led you to law school?
You know, part of it was I always wanted to enter public service. You know, I remember as a kid reading a lot of American history books and biographies, you know, in high school and college. And one thing I noticed was those who were in public service, you know, were lawyers or went to law school. You know, so I remember, you know, reading about the Cold War and, John Foster Dulles, you know, the Secretary of State under President Eisenhower, and he was a lawyer. I think he may have been like a partner at Sullivan and Cromwell. Even, you know, infamous figures like Alger Hiss, you know, was a lawyer. So, you know, I thought, okay, you know, if you want to enter public service, you know, you should go to law school. But I guess, you know, in terms of why I wanted to enter public service, you know, I think it comes from, you know, my family and especially my dad. You know, there's kind of old saying that, you know, those who are Americans by choice, not by birth, sometimes have, you know, greater appreciation of our, you know, liberties we have here. And I think it's definitely true with our family. You know, my dad loved America, everything about it. And not just, you know, the freedoms we have or our political system, but even, you know, small trivial things. You know, he loved, for example, Burger King. One of the pictures I have here, as old picture, my favorite pictures of me and my dad standing in front of a Burger King drive-thru, and I'm holding a huge bag of, you know, burgers and fries. And you would think that we were, you know, standing in front of, you know, the Washington Monument or Lincoln Memorial, but you want to take this picture. And one of the reasons why is, you know, in Korea, you know, especially again in the 70s when he grew up, you know, beef was expensive. You know, only the rich people ate beef. And then we come to the United States, we go to Burger King, and you could have a Whopper, you know, your way for whatever it was, $1.49. My dad was like, this is great. This is the greatest country in the world. And he was excited. And I still remember him, you know, saying, let's go take a picture in front of the drive-thru. So we're standing there taking a picture. So, you know, if you grow up with that kind of attitude, you know, rubs off on you. You know, I can't say I love Burger King as much as my dad did, but, you know, grow up to be very patriotic and, you know, want to serve this country.
Well, you ended up excelling, magna cum laude from Harvard, clerked with Judge Emilio Garza on the Fifth Circuit. What was that clerkship like?
It was a wonderful experience. You know, Judge Garza was a, you know, he's still alive, but he's since retired. But he was a great judge and a good man. You know, just on a personal level, he was a decent man. Is a decent man. I think his parents grew up in Mexico. He served his country in the Marines, then later, you know, as a state court judge, then finally as a federal judge. You know, he wasn't afraid to do what was right, even if it wasn't a popular one. And I still remember the thing he told all the clerks on the first day. And he said, you know, you guys will be my eyes and ears here. You have to make sure we get everything right. You know, this will likely be the last chance that a litigant will have before court, you know, because the Supreme Court, you know, back then maybe took 100, you know, plus cases. Now it's probably down to 50 or 60. And he said, so we've got to make sure we get it right. And, you know, that's the exact same speech I give to my clerks today.
Besides that speech at the beginning, did he have any other traditions with his clerks?
Yeah, he did. You know, he was, you know, proud Texan, like I think most Texans are. So he, you know, wanted the clerks to experience, you know, have the Texan experience. So I remember, I think we went to a rodeo, which again, if you grow up in Los Angeles or Korea, you know, you don't see too many rodeos. I think we were going to, but we didn't end up doing it. Go to a high school football game again, because that's huge in Texas. And he also always had tea time at 4 p.m. We'd have tea and we'd just chat. You know, didn't have to be about cases, but just about life, current news, whatever it might be.
Oh, that's lovely. So after your clerkship, you went to New York, the elite powerhouse Wachtell Lipton. What was that experience like?
You know, it was, I learned a lot. It was intense too.
I can imagine.
You know, the nice thing about a place like that is everyone there is incredibly bright, very motivated, and they work hard. So everyone lifts their weight. I think my first year there, I think I built over 3,500 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's no way I could do that now. But the crazy thing was, you know, several of the senior partners build even more hours than I did. So, you know, I remember on many occasions that, you know, 1 a.m. emailing a senior partner and he'd respond immediately because he was in his office, you know, down the hallway. Again, I learned a lot, but, you know, there's no way I can lead that lifestyle now.
Sure. What were some of the cases you worked on?
Sure. The big case I worked on there was a case involving insurance coverage for the World Trade Center after September 11th. You know, when we think of the Port Authority, you know, most people think of the Port Authority bus terminal in Times Square. It's scuzzy, you know, rats everywhere, and you don't want to be anywhere near it. But Port Authority also built the original World Trade Center, and they had decided to lease it to a private real estate developer, and they entered into a 99-year lease in August 2001. Yeah. Unfortunately and tragically, of course, a month later, terrorists attacked the World Trade Center. And there was insurance coverage for $3.5 billion per occurrence. So the question before us was whether this was one occurrence or two occurrences. Some people might say it's one occurrence because it was one terrorist attack at the World Trade Center complex. Others would say these were two planes hitting two towers. Therefore, two occurrences and thus $7 billion worth of coverage. I spent, you know, first 2-3 years of my time there on that case. You know, it's a business case, but it also felt like it was a righteous case because the money would be used to build, rebuild Ground Zero in the World Trade Center. And, you know, it was a great learning experience because, you know, you learned everything from the beginning, you know, to the end, because I had started a Wachtell about 6 days after 9/11. And
oh, wow.
I remember the first day starting there and going to Herb Wachtell's workroom. He had his own little workroom and drafting the complaint. And, you know, he had the old 1950s typewriter, you know, where you had the carriage return after you finished the line, and sitting there drafting the complaint, you know, then discovery, summary judgment, interlocutory appeal from the Second Circuit, trial. And, you know, back to the Second Circuit. So it was a good learning experience.
Yeah. Interesting. So while you were at Wachtell, you did something which I didn't know you could do as a big law associate. You took a leave of absence and served as a special counsel to the Senate Judiciary. What did that entail?
Sure. I was able to take a short leave of absence after the, you know, World Trade Center case, I think, you know. If you build 3,500 hours, they give you a little more leeway and say, okay, you can take a little time off.
I can imagine. I'd hope. I would hope.
This was, you know, we've been kind of a little bit spoiled, especially if you're SCOTUS podcasters, by the fact that we've had 4 Supreme Court nominations in whatever the past, 5, 6 years. Mm-hmm. But, you know, back in the day, I think there was an 11-year gap, I think, between Justice Breyer and Chief Justice Roberts. And Senator Spector, who was then the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, wanted several lawyers to join him just on a temporary basis to advise him on nomination process and legal issues. So, you know, I was enlisted and, you know, helped out. And, you know, Senator Spector isn't a warm and fuzzy guy. You know, he's one of these people you kind of wonder, like, how in the world did he get elected? Because he's not really a people person. But a very smart guy. He was a very smart person, wanted to understand the issues. You know, he's not one of those types who just gets talking points from staffers and reads it. He really wanted to understand it. And again, that had been an 11-year gap. So he really wanted to be prepared. So that was just a short, you know, leave of absence to help out during that process.
Interesting. So the next year, you joined the White House as special assistant to President Bush. What did you do in that position?
Sure. I worked at the counsel's office. And the White House counsel's office is sort of like the in-house legal department for the White House. We're not litigating cases, but we provide advice to White House officials on everything from ethics to, you know, potential legal problems with a policy initiative. You know, we work with DOJ on litigation that, you know, was of high interest to the White House. And then, you know, we did things like judicial nominations and, you know, pardon. Mm-hmm. It's the best job you could have if you love American history or public policy.
Interesting. And eventually resisted the call or the pull of New York, D.C., went back home to L.A., back to private practice at Jenner and Block. What motivated you to return home?
Sure. You know, I always knew I wanted to return back home to California. You know, it's, you know, right now winter, it's 70 degrees outside. So, you know, that's, you know, one thing I knew I'd always would want to come back, and especially because, you know, all my family California. But for this one, it was, you know, maybe a little bit earlier than expected. My, you know, dad was became sick. He was diagnosed with brain cancer, glioblastoma, which is the same thing that, you know, I think Senator Ted Kennedy and Senator John McCain was diagnosed with. So I knew time was short. So I was just going back home to take care of, you know, my dad, spend time with them, and, you know, help out my mom.
So what did you do when you returned to California in private practice?
Sure. And I joined Jenner and Block. They had just opened the LA office. You know, I did a wide variety of things, but my focus was on class actions, defense work, and especially for food companies. You know, there were, you know, a lot of class action lawsuits against food companies, companies for alleged mislabeling. You know, that, you know, product is labeled as 100% natural, and some plaintiffs would say that was inaccurate. And, you know, at that time, there still are a lot of these lawsuits, but many of them were being filed in the Northern District of California, dozens. And in fact, it was at one point dubbed, quote, the food court, because so many lawsuits were being filed there. So that was, you know, a large focus when I was in Los Angeles.
And eventually nominated to the Ninth Circuit by President Trump. What was it like to be nominated?
Sure. You know, at first, you know, it seemed surreal that it's happening, you know, when you get the call saying you'll be nominated. You know, other times, you know, also, you know, you kind of feel a sense of imposter syndrome. You know, you wonder, wow, you know, why me? You know, there are so many other lawyers who are, you know, smarter, more experienced. You know, am I capable of doing this job? There's also, you know, a lot of excitement. Calling my mom and telling her that I was going to be nominated. You know, I remember my mom, you know, telling me, I wish your dad were still here. You know, he loved America so much, and, you know, he'd be so proud and happy that you're being nominated. So, you know, all that, you know, excitement, sense of, you know, things being surreal. And then, of course, you know, you have your hearing and you're like, okay, this isn't as pleasant as it was when you get the call.
Sure. So when you were confirmed, you took a seat which had previously been held by Judge Stephen Reinhardt. Can you compare your judicial philosophies?
Sure. I'll say Judge Reinhardt was an incredibly bright and smart judge. And from what I hear, was a very hardworking judge, devoted to his job and spent long, long hours. That being said, we're probably, polar opposites when it comes to our philosophies. It's kind of like Professor X versus Magneto. some people may think that I'm the Magneto. I could say, one federal judge actually recently told me when he learned that, I had taken a seat that Judge Reinhardt had. He said, well, you may be of the more recent nominees. You may have the highest WAR, wins above replacement, the baseball metric. I think Judge Reinhardt probably had a more expansive role of the judiciary, of what it can do. I probably more in the mold of, what Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist Paper number 78, I think the judiciary is the least dangerous branch and should have a much more modest role. We have here in the Ninth Circuit, we have judges with different philosophies and how to approach mm-hmm. difficult legal issues.
How have you found the work of being a judge after a career in private practice?
It's the best job you could have as a lawyer. It's every day you get fascinating cases. There are very few jobs you can say that, what you're doing is, upholding the Constitution and our laws. So it's a fantastic job. It has everything that I liked about being a lawyer, but, not having to do the things I didn't like as a lawyer.
Mm. Have you, besides adopting Judge Garza's admonition to his clerks, have you adopted any of your own traditions?
I think there are a few. We have a, Christmas holiday party at our house, and we invite the clerks and their significant others. We also have a, farewell party in our backyard at the end. And, I also go to lunch with my law clerks almost every day. Sometimes we talk about the law, sometimes about sports or current events or music or whatever it might be. In terms of outside the chambers, I encourage my clerks to, have fun here. My chambers are about a mile away from the beach. So, I tell them to go paddleboarding, to go swimming, to enjoy it. But, they don't need me there, my swim truck's running around, I'll let them handle that themselves.
You mentioned your Burger King photo with your father. Do you have other mementos in chambers?
Yeah, I do. I have the usual mementos that you accumulate in D.C. That are here. But I also have lots of sports memorabilia and Star Wars memorabilia. Everything from autographed bat from Don Mattingly, autographed photos of, Peyton Manning, Hulk Hogan, you name it. I used to have all of this at home because I had a man cave. once we had our daughters, my wife, told me, okay, the man cave is becoming a room for the kids. Get the stuff out of the house. So I had to move it. But I did, a few years read an interview of Justice Alito by Brian Garner, the legal writing group. Mm-hmm. And I think Brian Garner kind of jokingly, tells Justice Alito, looks like you have more, baseball memorabilia in your chambers than, legal books. And he responded, yes. He says, yeah, Mrs. Alito, told me to get this stuff out of the house. So I feel like, look, if a Supreme Court justice can't keep his, sports memorabilia, at home, who am I, an inferior court judge, to complain? So they're all in my chambers. I also do have three arcade games in my chambers, Ms. Pac-Man, a Star Wars, old Atari Star Wars, and mm-hmm. Tron game. A lot of this is really nostalgia. Back in the day, we didn't have Xbox or PlayStation. So as a kid, there was a liquor store around the corner from our house. So I would spend hours just hanging out at liquor stores, which I know now sounds terrible, but back in the day, kids would just hang out at liquor stores, watching other kids play video games, these arcade games. So there's a nostalgia factor. So I have that there. And sometimes I compete with my law clerks on who can get the highest warrant in Pac-Man.
Your chambers sound like a lot of fun. Well, Judge, it's been great to have you on. I want to ask you one final question before you let you go. And it is, if you could have a conversation with any Supreme Court justice, living or dead, who would it be and what would you talk about?
I was thinking Justice Harlan, you know, the great dissenter, mm-hmm. Because I remember, you know, in college reading his dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson. And thinking to myself, you know, wow, this just makes so much intuitive sense. I couldn't articulate as well as he could, but it just made sense. And it's just, I think, one of the few times, you know, where I've had that, you know, experience after reading something. You know, I think, you know, the others were, you know, maybe reading, you know, John Locke's Second Treatise of Government, and, you know, maybe one of Thomas Sowell's books, you know, where you're reading and go, wow, this is just, you know, I don't have that, you know, overarching philosophy or knowledge or experience, but this just kind of strikes a chord. So I was going to say him, but then, you know, there's this old saying, you know, never meet your idols. and, you know, I don't know if our conversation could top, you know, the eloquence in his, you know, in his dissents. So, you know, maybe, you know, I would pick, you know, maybe an unorthodox choice, maybe Justice Brennan, just to probe him to understand his conception of the role of the judiciary, you know, how he came to that view. And he's, you know, a bit of a paradox because, you know, he's associated as being progressive, but, you know, his personal life, you know, I think there's this story of how apparently he refused to hire female clerks for years. Until finally, I think one of his former clerks almost threatened to expose him for this practice. And he finally hired a female clerk who is a judge on the Ninth Circuit. So it's very fascinating. So just to probe his mind about things like that and how he came to his own philosophy.
Very interesting. Well, Judge, it's been a delight to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
Now, Zach, you know what time it is?
My favorite time of the week, I'm sure.
It is your favorite time of the week. At the very least, it's my favorite time of the week.
All right, GC, let's get this trivia over with.
I think you'll like trivia this week. It comes totally out of the blue. It is about justices who served in the military.
Oh, are you interesting. Ready? This does sound interesting, GC, and I am ready. Let's do it.
Okay. Starting off easy, who is the most recent justice to have served, and in what service, and at what rank?
So I think Justice Alito is the only current justice to have served in the military, the only current justice who's a veteran. And I believe he served in the Army, although I'm not sure of what his final rank was, although I'm sure he was an officer.
Yes, well done. He was a captain in the Army.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
All right, a little harder. Who was the first justice to serve? And bonus points if you can tell me the service and the rank.
Well, I'm assuming it was one of the first justices appointed to the court because many of the first justices were veterans of the Revolutionary War. I'll go with the first Chief Justice, John Jay, because I know in addition to his many other diplomatic and legal accomplishments, he was also a veteran as well, I believe.
Yes, well done. Chief Justice John Jay served in the New York militia during the Revolutionary War and was a colonel.
Oh, interesting. All right.
So in addition to Jay, 8 future justices served in the Revolutionary War. Can you name, let's say, 2 of them?
Well, I know John Marshall did. Yep. Chief Justice John Marshall. I know he was one. And then I believe George Washington's nephew, Bushrod Washington, also served during the Revolutionary War.
Yes, well done. In addition to Washington and Marshall, we had Thomas Johnson, who was in the Maryland militia, William Paterson, who was in the Minutemen, Alfred Moore in the Continental Army, Brockholst Livingston in the Continental Army, Thomas Todd, also the Continental Army, and Gabriel Duval, who was a private in the Maryland militia.
Interesting. Well, all I can say, GC, is I'm very glad you didn't ask me to name three justices, because then I might have been in a little bit of trouble.
My memory gets a little fuzzy about some of those old ones, too. All right, number four. One of the men who served in the Revolutionary War worked closely along General George Washington and later in life wrote a biography of George Washington. Do you know who it was?
I think it was Chief Justice John Marshall.
You are knocking it out of the park today, Zach, much to my disappointment. It was indeed John Marshall. The only book he ever wrote was a five-volume biography of General Washington. It remains to this day one of the best biographies of Washington ever written. And last up, in which war or wars did the most future Supreme Court justices serve?
Well, that's a good question, GC. There's a lot to choose from. I would have to guess it would either have to be one of the World Wars or the Civil War, and I would probably guess the Civil War as my answer.
It is a good guess, but actually there's a tie between World War I and the Revolutionary War. In both wars, nine future justices served, which is one more than in World War II, and actually two more than the Civil War, which comes in fourth.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well,
yes, indeed. I think we'll do Justices in Uniform Part 2, because there's a lot more trivia out there we can do about this.
Well, I think it's a good topic, a very interesting topic, and I'm actually looking forward to Part 2, GC. So well done.
You looking forward to trivia? All right, we'll definitely do it then.
Excellent. Well, that's it for today. Thank you to everyone for listening to SCOTUS 101. Please be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And as always, we'd appreciate if you left us a five-star rating.
You can follow us on X at SCOTUS101 and email us at SCOTUS101@heritage.org with your questions, comments, or ideas for future shows.
Case is submitted.
You've been listening to SCOTUS 101, brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. Executive produced by Giancarlo Canaparo and Zach Smith. Sound designed by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Popp. For more information, visit heritage.org.